We'd Like a Word.
Welcome back to part two of this episode of We'd Like a Word, talking about how trauma can shape the telling of a story. With me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Coleman.
And our guests are Jeff Gudgeon, the author of a number of books, and his latest one is Draca, and General Sir Peter Wall, the former head of the General Staff, controller of all things army in Britain. You've both been in the services, and I would like to hear some stories of your times. And there's one thing, so Peter, you've been in all sorts of places. I mean, your services involve Belize, Rhodesia, which shows how far back it stretches, Afghanistan, the Balkans, Iraq. And I, having been to Zimbabwe a bit, I was particularly interested in your time in Rhodesia, just at the handover from the white-controlled government to the more, well, initially democratic state of Zimbabwe. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, this was at the end of the Rhodesian Civil War. It was essentially under white rule, but it was besieged by two insurgency groups, communist type sort of Soviet Chinese proxy type organizations, which were quite common around the world in those days, in the Cold War years. The two organizations were, one was led by Mr. Mugabe. He was the political leader, and they were called ZANLA, but they were essentially the Shona insurgency, supported with external bases in Mozambique. And then on the west side of the country, Joshua Nkomo, who many people will remember, very charismatic African political leader, with a military force called ZIPRA, which was the Ndebele tribe, the sort of descendants of the Zulus. And they had encroached into all of the rural areas around the major towns, and were encroaching on the towns. And essentially a ceasefire was negotiated by the then Lord Carrington, who was the Foreign Secretary, and a Commonwealth monitoring force was put together to go and police the ceasefire, which was going to start just after Christmas, late December 1979.
This was one of your first proper out there tense jobs in the army, wasn't it?
Yeah, you were a young officer. The first operation I had been on, I was in the Royal Engineers Parachute Squadron, which is known as 9 Squadron Royal Engineers, and I had been on a 6-month tour of Belize, which was, it was exciting and it was quite exotic in part. And so we came back from that, and you know, we had our marching orders in about November that this thing might start, and our squadron was asked to produce a team of people led by a young officer, and I was that person. So I was horrendously inexperienced. And the interesting thing about this was that it wasn't a type of operation for which there was any doctrine, you know, any recipe book, any manual. And I well remember sitting with the force commander, who was Brigadier Learmonth, and sitting with him at the front of a classroom in a school in Salisbury, which is now Harare, of course, and a group of us, about 20 young officers, you know, who never really met before, all sitting around from different regiments, and him giving us a sort of tutorial on what this might look like, bearing in mind no one had ever done it before, and we were all going to slightly different parts of the country in different situations. And I never forgot that. And of course, it was, of course, really good advice. Everyone's scribbling feverishly into their notebooks. And then we all got into these C-130s with our mine-proofed Land Rovers. And we were flown to a place called Lupani, which is on halfway up the road between Bulawayo and Victoria Falls in the western part of Rhodesia, as it was then. And, you know, then we set off from there the next day up country with a guy from the Patriotic Front. He was known as the Patriotic Front Liaison Officer. He was essentially a political commissar wearing military rank, brand new sort of East German type combat kit, brand new weapon, almost out of the packet. No, even the grease hadn't been taken off it, inevitably an AK-47. And we drove up to the place where we were going to set up our what was called rendezvous point, where at the appointed hour, the appointed morning anyway, which was a couple of days later, the ceasefire was going to be formally imposed, and it was the opportunity for the Zipra freedom fighters. If you were, you know, if you were monitoring them, they were effectively in that role rather than terrorists. And they outnumbered us hugely. There were about 1,500 to 2,000 came through this place, and we sort of received them, and they were then bused back to places called assembly areas, where they were kept for the next 2 or 3 months, pending the free and fair elections, which happened, I think, about the end of March or early April, I can't remember, 1980.
So how on earth did you manage to kind of keep control over such a huge, disproportionate number of guests? What did you? How did you occupy them?
Well, when we got them, I mean, the interesting thing was forging the right sort of relationship with them. And if there were 10 of us in our rendezvous team, and at no time were there fewer than 400 or 500 of these Zipra soldiers who had, frankly, succeeded in the war and were now looking for, you know, the way forward and birth of a new country. And of course, there was considerable doubt about whether the, you know, what the political representation was going to be, because our people were in the numerical minority in terms of their tribes. But then when we all got back to this place called Assembly Place Mike, which was out in the bush near Lipana, beautiful countryside, still with quite significant wildlife around, which I have to say, you know, our younger soldiers were more worried about the wildlife than they were the enemy, funnily enough, because of the risk of bilharzia and, you know, crocodiles and all these sorts of things. And I wasn't particularly keen on them either, but I could see the problems of a revolt from the people who we were meant to be looking after. So we were the sort of tethered goat for the 2,000 people in Assembly Place Mike. And had they wanted to take us hostage or whatever, we would have not had a chance. And so maintaining these relationships was important. And so we used to have a football match every day on this vast sort of, it was big enough. It was about the size of 4 football pitches. I'm not a chip footballer, I'm more of a rugby guy. I've sort of got 2 left feet, but we all had to turn out. And we would muster about 15 people who were prepared to play. They would typically have 40 or 50 on their side. A crowd of about 1,000 people watching. A typical scoreline would be, you know, Zipra 38, Brits, or in fact, Colonial Force 5 or 4. And that was only if we'd got into a bit of argy-bargy in their penalty area. The chap who was the referee was, actually had an artificial leg, and he wore the flying helmet of the pilot of a plane they'd shot down. And much to my irritation, he wore the stable belt, you know, the coloured belt of a Rhodesian Army Royal Engineer, or Rhodesian Army Engineer officer they'd killed. And we're all Royal Engineers, so we're not kind of thinking this is great PR, not great branding on their part, to use a modern expression. And the game only ended after about normally 2.5-3 hours, when we were actually on our chin strap. When one or two of our blokes would sort of drop the shoulder and physical contact started out of frustration, and they didn't do physical contact, and they said, right, we're taking our ball away now, see you tomorrow at 2 o'clock. So we were as fit as you could imagine.
I love that story. It is redolent of, you know, playing football between the trenches at Christmas in World War One.
And I suppose there's a film in it. There's definitely a film in it. I just want to see the referee with the one leg and the flying helmet.
Jeff, you'll easily have a better story than that from your time in the Navy.
Paul, you have a way of putting people on the spot. You realise that? Not only go into my background, but then you put a guy who was a not very good lieutenant up in front of a 4-star general and say, beat that! I don't think the Navy was quite ready for me. I always wanted to be a seaman officer and wear binoculars and drive ships. But I was too blind for a seaman and too thick for an engineer, so they put me behind a desk and told me to get the spuds in. And I don't think I was a particularly good supply officer. Would never have been a good supply officer. I was always a bit irreverent, I think, and disrespectful of authority.
So you're on your very, very best behaviour today, I'm noticing.
I am indeed, yes. But I think the peak of my naval career came when I blew up my commanding officer.
Tell that story, come on.
Quite, 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 quite deliberately, with humour aforethought, as they say, my last appointment in the Navy was ashore-based in what the Navy called the Stone Frigate. And the mess was run by a guy called the Staff Commander, who was a guy with a very distinguished record and relatively little sense of humour. And whenever he sat in the mess, he was in this throne-like chair, big oak-carved chair. And one Christmas lunch, I arranged a little surprise for him, and I screwed to the bottom of his chair a small amount of plastic explosive and an electronic detonator. And this was back in the days when you could actually still make jokes about these things. And I ran the wires down his chair leg and across to where I was going to sit in the mess, where I taped a 9-volt battery and a button underneath the table. And during the course of Christmas lunch, he got very upset with some junior officers who were getting rather frivolous and Christmassy, and he started banging his gavel and getting quite purple in the face. And I waited until everyone, really banged his gavel, and everyone shut up and looked at him, and I pressed the button. And as silly japes go, it was spectacularly successful. There was this great ball of smoke, because I tested this thing out in the open air in a field to make sure I had non-lethal quantities of PE in there. And sure enough, it was a non-lethal quantity of PE. But out in the field, you don't recognize how much smoke is going to be created. So there was this huge ball of smoke where the SAF commander had been. And as people opened the windows and then it cleared, the poor guy was halfway through the fruit bowl swimming for air. And he sort of climbed to his feet and looked down. And I'm literally, there were quite senior officers who were falling off their seats, quite literally falling off their seats with laughter. But the timing had been immaculate, absolutely immaculate. And he looked down his chair and he saw these wires running across the mess. And he realized that he could either get down on his knees and crawl and follow the wires and make himself look a complete fool, or he could take it as a joke. And he took it as a joke. So that was the pinnacle of my career, I think, blowing up my commanding officer.
You were clearly in the wrong job. I mean, the wrong branch of the military.
I would have loved to. I love things going bang. I would love to be in a gunnery officer or something like that. I didn't have the eyesight for it.
Peter, if you'd still been in uniform and heard about something like that, what would you have felt compelled to do?
That's a very good question, because as Jeff alluded to, telling his excellent story, back in the day, a lot of that went on. Mm. And now people have a sort of much more refined idea about how much danger you can embrace in the sort of jolly japes that people get into. So I think that, obviously, officially, it's not a good thing to be doing. First of all, where did the plastic explosive come from? Secondly, where did the detonators come from? And thirdly, what training did the people have before they went about this completely illegal act? You know, you'd have the whole book thrown at you if you looked at it through a purist lens. But then you might have people, still have people who've got a sense of humour and recognise that there's scope for people letting off steam in those sorts of situations. I hope we haven't lost that completely, but I would say the aperture has narrowed very considerably, because people don't sort of have quite the same appetite to that sort of risk. People often ask me whether the military is as much fun for people joining nowadays as it was when we all joined, because inevitably it's a very serious enterprise, but it's got a massive inbuilt sense of humour, which is its lifeblood, really. And it's the way it handles stress most of the time, actually, although that doesn't work in the most extreme cases, as we know. But and some things just aren't funny, and you can't use gallows humour. But there's certainly a place for people being able to do the outrageous. And, you know, just the way the military is structured compared with the rest of society is a source of humour anyway. I mean, you know, the typical thing being the drill sergeant on the square at Sandhurst when you first join out of school or university. And, you know, frankly, those habits probably haven't changed for a couple hundred years. You know, it's just what you do. It's part of the drill. So I do hope that fun ensues, and I suspect that probably it would need to be a good day before anybody passed over plastic explosive going on under going off under a senior officer in the officer's mess.
Does it remind you, Peter, of any incidents that you might have been caught up in when you were a junior officer?
Definitely. I remember when I was an instructor at Sandhurst, the college commander, who was an artilleryman, had procured 2 25-pounder guns to be sort of what are known as gate guardians, you know, display pieces. And these had obviously been neutralised in terms of their ability to fire. But we discovered after a slightly alcoholic instructor's lunch, when all our charges, the younger cadets, student officers, were off on some other escapade, they weren't our responsibility that day, that if you put a thunder flash down the barrel and followed it very quickly with a smoke grenade with the pin out, it created quite an interesting effect at the other end of the sports pitches, and these things will go about 200 or 300 yards. This didn't impress the deputy commandant, who was hosting some overseas officers, and they didn't understand why the instructors were engaged in this alcohol-induced activity. We were all in big trouble. This was admittedly back in the... This was in 1983, I think, something like that. So, that sort of stuff went on, I'm afraid. It was all behind the wire. It was all reasonably innocent. Just backfired slightly on that occasion.
Just think where you could have got in your career if you hadn't been caught.
Well, we weren't. We still got away with it. I mean, you know, it's not so much the issue as the way you handle it. You know, well-aimed apology is a good thing.
I was a police officer for 30 years in London, and in the early days of the police service, again, as you say, the letting off steam, the being a little bit bored on night duty, the pranks and japes went on all the time, and it was an accepted part of the job. You know, it was. And once things got a little bit more serious, I mean, one thing I particularly remember is that everyone got a nickname. The minute you joined your shift or your relief, you got a nickname. But now they're not allowed to have nicknames because it's something being imposed on people. So therefore, it's not abusive, but it's a form of bullying. So now it's not acceptable. Things have changed a lot. But saying that, I talked to quite a few young police officers because I'm doing this project at the moment, and they still seem to have fun. Maybe not quite as boisterous as we did, but they still have fun to a degree, and they still use humour as a way of reconciling some of the terrible things they have to see and deal with. So, I mean, I think it will always be there.
I think that's critical, actually. That the point about humour as a stress reliever and as a sort of way of generating camaraderie and that sort of thing. And clearly, you know, bullying is a very unfortunate consequence of the wrong sort of camaraderie, where you get tribalism with an organisation and people want to take it out on some of the more vulnerable and less fortunate people. But
so, I mean, that leads me to another question. Coming back to PTSD. We generally associate it with the sort of the ground troops, you know, the people on the ground. I mean, it must exist within the higher echelons of rank as well. How is that dealt with? Because that must be very, very tricky to speak about.
Well, I think it's very interesting. There's no doubt about it that, you know, I've witnessed people who have come back from commanding formations where it was absolutely not their job to be caught in the front line. They were very much, commanding perhaps a brigade of 5,000 to 8,000 people, and not going to be a foot soldier unless there was a particular reason. And they would be at risk going to meetings with local dignitaries. There was always a risk of that sort of thing going on.
There's also they're having to make life and death decisions
where there is a very high toll on casualties and people killed in action, then that has a sort of compound stress on the whole organisation, and the person who's bearing the brunt will be the battle group commander or the brigade commander. And, you know, after specific periods in specific places, you can imagine the toll it's having on people, and you can see a change in their demeanour and behaviour. And it could be a form of sort of PTSD from a distance, born of a slightly different rationale, which they probably handle personally through having very strong family, having strong peers, and generally having a strong sort of supportive network. But it definitely, and in some cases, then it transforms it. So if it sort of goes across the line into something more medically recognizable. But you're absolutely right. I'm sure it goes on.
I mean, extraordinary thing to have to make, to take that degree of responsibility. I mean, I couldn't do it, and I don't know how anyone does it, frankly, but they do. I mean, throughout history, they've always had to do this.
That's the end of part two of this episode of We'd Like a Word with General Sir Peter Wall and Jeff Gudgeon, author of Draca. Coming up in part three, we'll be hearing a bit from Draca, and we have some audience questions for both you, Jeff, and you, Peter, coming up in part three.